why are we here? Or can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things and breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life of Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Justine Toe.
Well, today we're going to lift the lid on Easter. We're going to talk to people on the street, what it means to them, think about what it means to us personally, and especially what we're thinking and writing about this Easter. Now, what about you guys? Is Easter weekend meaningful for you?
It is and it isn't. It's incredibly meaningful in terms of the spiritual significance of Easter. But in terms of a practical, what do I anticipate Easter? I anticipate the long weekend. That's what I anticipate. I'm sorry.
It's good to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it similarly to the way that I think about when anniversaries come up, especially my wedding anniversary. Incredibly meaningful event. Still meaningful. We commemorate it every year and it's joyful and wonderful, but I'm not like organizing my life around it, if I can put it in those terms. Yeah.
Now, Natasha, Easter weekend for you, is it meaningful?
I think for me, it's been becoming more meaningful over time. I think I used to feel a bit the same, that it was like, oh, it's suddenly here and I'm relieved there's a holiday and then it's over and we move on with our lives. But I think maybe because the way that my church celebrates it, we have this series of events, like on the Thursday night, we have a thing called Dark Church where there's like candles and they blow them out and it's very somber. And then Good Friday, thinking about the death of Jesus, and that's quite somber as well. And then that leads into this Easter Sunday, which is quite like it's a bit of a party and it's upbeat and there's decorations in the church and you really feel the difference. So I think you kind of live into this story in a way.
It's a great rhythm to that, isn't
it? Yeah.
And it reflects rhythms of other parts of our lives, surely.
Yeah, because we actually, you can't just sit and think about these things and be like, oh, that's meaningful. Like, you sort of have to live them
and over take part in the, yeah, in the story in that sense. Yeah.
Okay, so the Easter weekend may or may not be particularly meaningful for some Christians, Justine. But what about your average person today?
I'm not, like, familiar with the Easter holiday, so I don't know much about it.
I was brought up as a Catholic and went to religious schools, so it has some sort of long dark meaning from a religious point of view, but otherwise it's a holiday.
So for Lent I've given up bread and chips and chocolate, and so that makes me extra excited for Easter Sunday so I can eat lots and lots of it.
Probably just to catch up with family and friends, I guess. It's a good time because there's a lot of public holidays next to each other. Coincidentally get sick and chuck a sickie.
I'm an atheist, so I don't celebrate it in the religious sense. For me, it's just a time to be with family.
Our whole neighborhood normally just goes out and looks for eggs, and whoever finds the most wings.
And we go to church at 10:30.
We actually boil eggs. We have chickens, and we color them and then hide them.
I think that most people don't have a strong feel for Easter in a spiritual sense, definitely. And that's part of the reason why we do public Christianity. In this case, Natasha and Simon are writing articles and I'm doing some stuff on the radio. We want to be able to join up the dots for people to show why this story matters today and matters to our lives personally.
Okay, so Justine, you're doing something for ABC. What's that about?
The segment is called Spiritual Life Hack and it sits within Soul Search, which is one of the Radio National programs on religion. And it's based around this idea that religion is this treasure trove of wisdom for life, but that as people are less religious today, I mean, the census would suggest that at least a third of people, would call themselves religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S. Perhaps people are less likely to look for a guidance in terms of the spiritual or the religious traditions. But at the same time, as I like to say, the nuns perhaps maybe none the wiser about how to live a good life. And so what we're trying to do in this program is talk to people of belief who can explain how they draw on their religious tradition in order to answer some very common life problems.
So you were working partly on this practice of Lent, this period of 6-7 weeks?
40 days-ish, I guess.
40 days plus the Sundays before Easter, and whether that's relevant for people.
Yeah, we started the series during Lent, a time of reflection for the believer, prayer, and often self-denial as a way to prepare for the story of the crucifixion of Jesus. Here's me talking to Matt Tan, a Catholic theologian. He talks about what he's giving up for Lent.
I've given up Netflix for Lent. I spend more time scrolling through the options than I do actually watching a program.
Yes, me too. Mm. Wow.
And it's not as if that my engagement with the content actually gets active. It's actually when I actually start watching a program, it basically becomes an opportunity for me to zone out. I even zone out of the program, which is something that I've become really cognizant of. And that mindlessness in consuming the content of Netflix was one of the prompts that made me decide, you know what, I really could do with removing myself from that mindlessness, even for this period of Lent.
So that was Matt Tan on Spiritual Life Hack. Now, Justine, what does Matt say he gets from this practice of, in this case, denying himself something?
Well, he says that we live in this economy of distraction, his lovely phrase, where everyone is always surrounded by screens and ways to distract yourself, essentially. But he talks about how this has a deadening effect on people in that in being distracted from what you're meant to be doing, he says, you actually become less than human in this. So he's found that as he's given up Netflix for Lent, that it's opened himself up in all sorts of ways. It's freed him to think about how his relationship with God is going. It's freed him up to think about, is he doing well at loving his neighbour? He's a Catholic. These things matter to people. And it's also been really great for his prayer life as well. So just by making that decision to not watch TV, like all these other possibilities have come in, and he experiences it very much as an opening up to the divine and to the possibilities that are there, rather than just becoming a zombie in front of the screen.
Is this something that has application for people who may not be believers themselves? So there's a sort of a discipline to life brought on by this sort of practice?
Yeah, I mean, like, people do techno Sabbaths all the time without actually being Christians or having any sort of association. They'll just give up their phones for the weekend or for Sundays. I think everyone can recognise that this is the sort of problem being diagnosed here is something that we all share. But what we're trying to do in this series is just show what the believer, in this case, what the Catholic believer, how he makes sense of that within his tradition and what in his tradition helps him to bring in some good disciplines, I suppose, to help him flourish.
Cope with modern life.
Yeah.
Because this is kind of, it's supposed to have ripples beyond the period of Lent or the, you know, period of time that you decide to give something up into the rest of your life. Like, I remember watching one of those commencement speeches that do the rounds on social media where the guy talked about, like, you know, scrolling through Netflix and not being able to commit to a movie and you know, after a while he's like, I'll give up, I've been doing this for half an hour, I'll just go to sleep. And he's like, I call it infinite browsing mode.
Yeah.
And it's actually maybe the defining characteristic of our generation, that this is not just Netflix, it's like, I want to keep my options open in life and not commit to things. And so maybe putting your finger on these particular practices can have wider, like, ripples for how we think about life in general.
Yes, I put that to him. I was kind of like, the sorts of realizations you're having at this time of year, surely they're applicable for all time, right? And he's like, yes, absolutely. And I think that's also what's great about Easter. It's like, yes, it's a discrete moment and it has particular meaning for the believer in that context, but it also has ripple effects beyond itself as well, and it should infiltrate the rest of life and make for a wholly different perspective that you bring to life itself.
Whilst I cannot give any confirmation at this stage around fatalities and casualties, what I can say is that it is clear that this is one of New Zealand's darkest days.
That's New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern after the Christchurch massacre. Now, just 2 days before that event in Christchurch, we were all at the Richard Johnson Lecture in New South Wales Parliament House, where Tim Dixon was giving a talk. And he said in that talk how it's a very short path from the contempt that we see in public discourse today towards violence. And he says these words have haunted him ever since. Of course, he couldn't have predicted how.
But it is really uncanny.
Oh,
yeah.
It's terrible. It's It is awful when you think about this. I think you even said, you know, we're a long way from a lot of this violence in New Zealand and Australia, and yet...
Yeah, that happened. You
know, it came up so quickly. So as we've been approaching Easter, I've been thinking about that, and in our unbelievably polarised times, what Easter has to say about it.
Yeah, because, I mean, the polarisation thing feels a bit like... we've been talking about this on Life and Faith for what feels like a few years now, and the whole culture is kind of talking about it, and it's not at all clear that it's getting any better rather than
worse. No, it doesn't seem to be getting better, and Tim Dixon made this point very clearly. He thinks this is a serious crisis and that we've got to find ways to do this differently. I was, in thinking about this, I was noticing an article that Peter Fitzsimons wrote. Fitzsimons is a well-known author of historical books and an ex-rugby player, very prominent in the media. And he
lefty journalist.
Yeah, he's a kind of lefty journalist. And he tweeted a photograph of him and the former Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, at a cafe. So they're both sitting there smiling. And he tweets this and says, you know, here I am with Tony Abbott. Now, it turns out they were kind of rugby mates 20, 30 years ago. But everyone knows, who know these two guys, they agree on almost nothing. Like, they're complete opponents when it comes to any sort of public discourse or political differences. And Fitzsimons says he put it up and just, you know, just as a kind of an attempt to say, you can be completely in disagreement with someone, but you don't have to be mortal enemies. That was the intention. But everything that came afterwards told him that, no, that isn't the case. Like, people were absolutely vitriolic in their criticism of him even sitting next to Tony Abbott. And I thought it was really quite indicative of the times we're in.
Very much like we're going to draw a line in the sand, pick your side, basically.
And you can't even be seen to associate with the opponent.
Question. So what does it have to do with
What's
Easter,
this
Simon?
Got to do with Easter? Is this a long bow I'm drawing? No, I don't think so, in the sense that, well, we needed some inspiration from somewhere. And as I started to think about Easter, it just reminded me of how Jesus engaged with difference and social alienation. And I was just reminded that whenever he met anyone, whether it was a Roman soldier or a kind of despised, hated tax collector, leper, prostitute, whoever it was, he always had this habit or ability to see the individual beyond whatever labels we might put on that person.
So you think that he'd happily tweet a picture of himself with Tony Abbott?
I think he would, and also with Peter Fitzsimons and everyone in between. He was known to mix with people who were despised in that culture, and he had absolutely no problem with doing that. He really was able to operate across all sorts of social and political boundaries. He saw beyond the angry tweet. He's always seen the person behind the story. I think that's really incredible.
Don't you think it's interesting also that Jesus was known for eating dinner with people? Like, he actually sat down and had a very embodied engagement in a way that was like around a meal. You know, you can't hate on someone when you're across the table from them.
Especially, and in that culture, to sit down and eat with someone was saying how much you
value them. Yes, and isn't it interesting then that at the end of Tim's lecture, you know, someone says, like, what can we do? How can we do our bit in order to sort of address polarization? And he ended on a very kind of everyday solution as well. He was like, gather people around your kitchen table. Have a conversation, have a meal.
People you wouldn't normally mix with. It's
exactly.
Easy to get the people you do mix with easily from your tribe.
Yes.
Talk to someone else.
Yeah, but I mean, also it's not just Jesus' dining habits that he offers kind of a good example of across lines, right? The claims are bigger than that.
That's a good point, Natasha. So his death is a pretty important part of the story where the claim goes, he dies for everyone, and not just the people in his tribe, even to the point of praying for the people who are torturing him and driving the nails into his body. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing, is the way it's recorded in the gospel. So this is a story that is a powerful mechanism for, I think, opening up a vision of real community that crosses over barriers of class and status and gender and race and nationality. And you see this at its best. You see this even in the way this Easter story will be remembered this weekend, for instance, where kneeling at the communion railing, if that's the way that particular tradition does it, but kneeling there, all sorts of people will be kind of shoulder to shoulder across all sorts of walks of life, hippies and, you know, anaesthetists and, you know, single moms and whoever it might be. And they're all united in their belief and their hope that this story actually means something for them today. It's sort of opening up all sorts of redemptive possibilities, I'd say. This is Life and Faith. We're talking about Easter. Now, every year at the Centre for Public Christianity, we write articles for the media at Easter and Christmas and other times. But when you come to something like Easter, and you've written about it lots of times before, you do sometimes find yourself saying, well, what am I going to talk about this year? And trying to find an angle. But there's such a richness to the story that somehow or other, you know, things come up. Now, Natasha, what are you doing this year?
Well, this kind of flows quite nicely in terms of, you know, we were talking about the Christian story having a rhythm to it, the Easter weekend. Yeah. So if Justine has been thinking and recording on the subject of Lent, and your article that you've been writing is about...
Well, I've been talking about...
Good Friday.
Good Friday and polarization, mm-hmm, and reconciliation.
Yep, the cross. So that leaves me with resurrection. Yep, I get the, you know, fun one. My inspiration for the one that I've been writing about is that I did an interview for our podcast. If you're a regular listener to our podcast, then, you know, people have heard this interview a few weeks ago. I talked to Alison Milbank, who's a British literary scholar and theologian. And there was this moment in that interview where things took a turn that I just really wasn't expecting.
I can't tell you that fairies don't exist. I don't really know. So I would be very careful to say that there are no fairies. And certainly when I was a child, I had experiences of fairies. And there are no fairies in the Bible, but that doesn't mean there are no fairies. But I think they kind of represent something on the edge of our consciousness.
So could someone actually say of Alison, she's off with the fairies, and actually mean it?
Well, you know, she is like a literary person. She likes books and fantasy and, you know, maybe...
What are you saying about literary people, Natasha?
Hey, I consider myself one of them. People often think I'm off with the fairies. They call it Tashland, my family.
Right. Yeah, wow. I'm
just elsewhere. But you know, I kind of usually... and Christian people or religious people in general can be a bit defensive about this claim when people are like, oh, believing in God or believing that Jesus rose from the dead is like believing in fairies at the bottom of the garden.
Well, I think
like,
they're rightly defensive about that.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, my response is usually to be like, here's all the reasons that those beliefs are very different. And then to hear Alison Milbank, that's kind of where I thought she would go when I asked her the question, was that she'd be like, oh, these are quite different things. Instead, she was like, well, I don't know that there aren't fairies. I'd be like, what?
Right. And so this tells you what about things like mysterious stuff and super...
Well, yeah. I mean,
transcendent things.
So the phrase that she gave me that I found really helpful is that she talked about a natural desire for the supernatural, that humans just, we believe in often... even people who say that they don't will often kind of believe in things that aren't just the material world, what you see. And there's a bunch of like stats and surveys and stuff that show this, that people who, you know, say they're atheists still pray daily, actually.
Yeah, wow.
And you don't know like, who that, well, yeah. Or, you know, people who say, oh, I don't believe in God or a higher power, but I do believe in the soul, or I do think that there's an afterlife. And
yeah, so all of these things are at least nudging you towards the immaterial, things that you can't measure. And
even things like ghosts or horoscopes or telepathy, like, like one response to that is for a lot of people get frustrated by that and go, oh, all my fellow citizens are idiots.
Crazy.
Because they believe in all these things. But actually there's something in humans that pushes us towards, I think there's something more, I just can't quite square with the world being all there is, with everything being atoms, and that's kind of it.
But you want to discern between things that you think are just crazy stuff and something that might be transcendent but real.
Well, you know, I do. I think we have a responsibility in thinking about our own beliefs to figure out what's reasonable and what the evidence is, because, you know, some beliefs are based on a lot more evidence than other beliefs. And particularly when we're talking about the resurrection of Jesus, for example, there's actually really good historical evidence for that. That's not a kind of random off with the fairies, so to speak, belief. But actually, I think if we want to go all, oh, well, let me kind of prove this to you by historical methods, like those things are important, but the resurrection is way more than that. And it answers to something in us that longs for more.
Don't you think in some ways that while obviously it's good to have reasonable reasons for why you believe X, Y, Z, that it has shut off an entire other dimension of human existence, which is the yearnings, the longings and the emotions, the female side, if you like, of the human experience. And so you're trying to maybe edge us back to considering this is a different path of knowledge, or at least shedding light on something that is really common to all of us. I mean, Game of Thrones on TV, everyone wants dragons, let's be honest. It's something that cuts across the whole human experience. We all long for this. It's not just a female thing.
Yeah, if it's just the politics on Game of Thrones, it's not nearly as interesting than if there's White Walkers and dragons and stuff. And I think, in fact, we just shouldn't necessarily divide those things, in that the fact that we yearn for this and that it's so fascinating to us is itself evidence, is itself data in figuring out what humans are like and what reality is like. So, you know, C.S. Lewis, one of my heroes, he, when he went from being like a staunch atheist to a Christian, one of the things that he said was that he always thought that Jesus dying and rising from the dead, that story was just, you know, a myth, and it was like all these other myths about dying and rising gods and, you know, the agricultural cycle. And realizing in a conversation with an atheist friend, like the, he says, the like most hard-boiled atheist he ever knew, who was like, actually, the historical evidence is good. It looks like it
for the resurrection, you
that
mean?
That myth might actually have happened historically once. And Lewis was a bit like, whoa, what are you kidding me? But coming to that realization that the resurrection could be both an historical fact and answer to all those echoes and cultural yearnings in these other stories, that it doesn't have to be one or the other, it can be both.
You've been listening to Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Justine Toe and Natasha Moore.
You'll be able to check out the articles and programs that we've been talking about here. We'll put links at our website, publicchristianity.org, and we hope they're of some use in joining the dots for you this Easter.
Happy Easter from all of us.
Okay.
Hey, rolling.
Oh. Hi, I'm Anna, the youth...
Start again, you peaked.
Sorry. Hi, I'm Anna, the youth editor here at CPX, just jumping in for a minute to talk to you about what may be the most exciting podcasting opportunity of 2019. Is there a burning question you want to explore, or a story you think isn't being told? If you're between the ages of 15 and 21, or you know someone who is, our second annual Life and Faith Youth Competition is now open. Pitch us your story by the 10th of May, for a chance to produce an episode of the podcast. Life and Faith needs you. Head to cpxyouth.org for all the details. It's fine. Is that okay?